Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Stapelman.
Yeah, so Chris, you know, let's welcome our guest here. You were talking just a second ago about the challenge of an organization that's trying to go quick. And I think you mentioned one of some book that you, it's got this approach to, instead of the product development going through stage gates and kind of long drawn out process, it was a lean startup framework, I think you called it. What was that book you mentioned?
Yeah, the book is called The Lean Startup by Eric Ries, and that's R-I-E-S for the last name.
Okay.
And he presents a framework around product development that has very fast innovation cycles. And the importance or the specialty of this approach is that you give your early adopter customers a product that is kind of in its infancy, and it's linked to the minimum viable product philosophy, where you just have some basic features you want to give to your customers, and you want to get customer feedback as early as possible to find out whether you're on the right track or not. Do your customers want the features that you think they want? You think your customers are having a problem that your product will solve. Is that really true? Do they perceive the same problem, and do they want this kind of solution to their problem? So you give them something that is very bare bones and sometimes not even of very high quality to get some initial and fast feedback. And what you want to avoid is creating waste in your development process. So if you create features in your product that customers don't want, you created waste. And that's why it's called the Lean Startup.
Okay.
And I've been wondering, if you're working through these fast cycles, you know, where does reliability engineering come in? I know at some point in time, you have to switch over to like a ramp phase where you ramp and grow your product once you figure out that you're on the right track and you've got the right product.
You know, by then, the reliability is baked in already. You know, that's a challenge, because you can't wait until you're ready to create products. You got to design it in. You know that.
Yes, you absolutely have to design it in. Some of the first products you give your customer may not be anything like the final product you're ramping.
Yeah, that's true. And I see the value of that bit. But before we dive into that in some more detail, because I see, and I have experienced it, and I'm sure you're running into this, it's a trade-off, right? Let's talk about how reliability fits into that, because there are some dilemmas there. Before we do that, let's pause for a quick message.
Hi, it's James Kovacevic here from HP Reliability. I encourage you, if you haven't had the opportunity yet, to download our free ebook on A Smarter Way of Preventative Maintenance. You can find that at ascendoreliability.com/go/PM. If you have any questions, need help with your current PM program, please don't hesitate to reach out at info@hpreliability.com. Thanks.
All right. Now, this Lean Startup book, in this book by Eric Ries, you know, I've certainly seen that, where it's a small company and you want to get a minimum viable proper product out, and you also want a product that actually works, that actually survives shipping and they can install and it works for 3 months, at least long enough for them to do a review, right? If you ship a product and half of them fail on the delivery, you're not going to get the reviews you really want, you know? So you were talking about, well, where do we put in this? Where do we get reliability engaged with the design team when they're really focusing on just get something out there? Is that a good paraphrase of the dilemma there?
Yeah. The team's trying to go as fast as possible, and they probably view anything that's a reliability or quality activity as something that holds them up. And I completely agree with what you're saying, Fred. You have to design reliability and quality into the product. You can't test it in, or you can't just assume it's there, because that's going to bite you once it's out in the field, and, and you will have quality and reliability issues.
Yeah. I mean, there are teams that get lucky and they create something rock solid, and it, you know, but it's, that's more the exception than the truth than happens. The hard part is that we are facing, I think stigma is the right word or not, but traditional old school was the quality engineer or the reliability engineer in the white lab coat with the check, you know, the clipboard at the end of the line saying, nope, that's not good enough, restart. And it's too little too late in the program. It's the gatekeeper kind of mentality. Whereas what, you know, and you've certainly heard me talking about it, is it's reliability is not in a product is not created by the reliability engineer. That's not our job. Our job is to make sure that the design team, the electrical engineers, mechanical engineers, software engineers, make the right decisions such that they achieve the reliability objective, right? So we're enablers. We're not doing the work to create a reliable product. And so when you mentioned that a lean startup team says, well, we're not going to do reliability because it's distracting. It takes us too far away from what we're doing. It'll take too long. Would you say that that's because of the stigma of a different way of doing reliability?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a stigma there, where reliability and quality is sometimes seen as the police that says stop. You know, you can't go any further than this until you do this and this and this and this. And we got to change the mindset to, we're partners in the development. So we can either be part of your design meetings, or we can create robust processes or guidelines for the designers. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Doesn't mean we have to micromanage every design decision, but we give the designers the right tools and knowledge to make those decisions. I've been using your quote about reliability happens when the designer makes a decision. Mm-hmm. So I've been using that here to talk to people within our organization. And they have to pause and think about that for a little bit. They think, well, reliability happens because we have a reliability engineer, but we really don't want to spend the time in testing. And yeah, so I have to explain that. It's like, we don't test it in, and I don't make the product more reliable just by being in the same office.
That's right. Now, I mean, ideally, you're aware of where the risks are. You're providing, you know, vendor selection type things. There's tools and experience that we bring as reliability engineers that certainly can help. Yet, at the end of the day, this design engineer says, we're going to go with this motor, not that motor, or this sensor, or not that sensor. And those decisions impact the reliability more so than us sitting in the same room or doing any test at the end of the day. If they want to go fast, right, it's a constraint. And all right, well, we're not going to do 300 samples for 6 months in an accelerated test. It's just not going to help anybody. It's always been, whatever the program is, well, what questions does the design team need to answer? What's at risk? What's most likely to fail? When will something fail? What's the best choice in this circumstance? How do we identify the weaknesses of our product? Are all typical questions design teams can have that's related to reliability. And then we can bring tools and techniques in to make that happen. But Chris, you mentioned, though, the frameworks or the structures for design teams to make good decisions, like derating guidelines for electronics, for example, is a great tool that influences the component selection. And it doesn't take any more time.
Yeah, correct. And that's one of the tools we're using here as well. One tool that I have been using is the, I mean, most reliable engineers hopefully use it, is the DFMEA.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. But it's still seen as a big time sink by the development teams. I'm wondering if there are ways to achieve what the FMEA is trying to achieve without it being a big formal process.
Well, it might be in the implementation of it. It's what I found to be successful with startups is, I mean, they've got way more on their plates to do every single day. So you're never going to get a full day of anybody's time. It's go in for a 2-hour session, make sure it's useful, right? Get as much out of it as you can, do the follow-up and reviews, and then do another, you know, break down the scope of each study so that you can get something useful in less than an afternoon. And the trick is that it's got to show something useful. If you can go back to the program manager and say, all right, of these top 10 priorities, if you do this one, which is identified as a major risk on your FMEA, you'll save time on everything else. You know, if you let it go, sit where it is now, it's going to come back and we're going to have to deal with it eventually. It's just an outstanding question. It's just another prioritization tool. And by helping the team focus on what's most important to solve, you know, other than functionality, then it saves everybody time. So it's finding those places that it actually made a difference and reminding them that it actually made a difference. But short, quick, same process, right, for an FMEA, but make it very concise. And, well, you've been in FMEAs where somebody says, oh, this button will break off. And another engineer jumps in and goes, well, we can redesign it this way. If we make the housing this much more thick, you know, and we can do this. And he pulls out some paper and he starts drawing sketches of the solutions for it. You've just wasted 20 minutes. Right. It's got to be very disciplined and very quick and say, all right, button's a risk. Write it down. Move on. What's next? You know, we're not solving it today. Right. It lists 100 things that could go wrong and pick the top 3 that we really need to solve. And it might be this button. It might not. So don't solve it today. Engineers love solving problems. And I think FMEA forces them to expand that. Right. And think about all the ways that could go wrong. And when you look at it that way, now I've got 100 things I need to go solve. No, you need to solve these 3. That's it. And then we move on. It's got to be in that kind of context, I found. Otherwise, they're just looking at it as I've got 400 more action items. I can't deal with this.
Yeah, I agree with that approach. You have to have some solid outcomes of FMEAs and make sure you follow up and follow through with the top risks that you identify. One other tool and approach, as I'm reading the Lean Startup book, and I haven't completely gone through it yet, so I'm still learning about the whole process, but I find it fascinating. And I find it fascinating because he uses the approach of hypothesis testing with the customers.
Mm-hmm.
You bring your minimal viable product out there and you have a hypothesis of how many percent of your customers will adopt this kind of technology or product. And then you test that, whether that's true or not. And then when your hypothesis proves to be correct, you continue in that direction. But if you disprove your hypothesis, then you pivot and you go change your direction to adjust course early on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that counts for product development and website design and all kinds of places. Is, you know, it's harder with physical products because to create something that actually works and you can hand it beyond your beta testers actually sell as a product. It's gotta work. It's gotta actually allow you to collect that information, right?
Yeah.
I've seen a number of products that have come to market and they're just, you know, yeah, we'll deal with reliability later, you know, kind of approach. And they ship something and they end up with 70% dead on arrival. they don't get a second chance, you know, unless they've got really deep pockets. So it's, at some point there's a threshold where if it's not viable at all, you're done. You won't get any information back because the product just doesn't work anymore. So you're just going to be getting complaints that they failed. But that's a hard story to sell to a team that's trying to get out a product and go quickly. And quick doesn't mean just skip whole reams of features. The marketing guys are still working hard, getting their information together. You still have to lay out a circuit board. It doesn't mean you don't do that step. I mean, reliability isn't a shortcut. It's part of those design team's role is to design a reliable product. The reliability engineers facilitates that, but doesn't do it. And that's a hard one to convince people of if they've come out of the traditional, especially the aerospace and military realms, where it's, you know, 5-year development cycles or longer. then it's a different story.
Yeah, here's one tool that Eric Ries talks about in his book. It's from the Lean Toolset, and it's the 5 Whys. Mm-hmm. And that's for those that are not familiar. You if you have a failure, you ask why did this failure happen, and you have an answer, and you ask, well, why did that happen? And you drill down further and further until you get to the root cause, which could or more often than not, is a human failure, be it in the design process or in the manufacturing process,
or understanding your customer. You know, they used your smartwatch as a hammer instead of a watch. And
yeah,
you
know, yeah,
that's great. The 5 Whys is a great tool. It's an excuse though, Chris. I've heard it used as an excuse. Right? They say, "I'll do 5 Whys. I'll get to root cause." But I'm not going to do root cause. I'm just going to do the back of the envelope 5 Whys example. And I get it down to its corrosion, right? Well, why is it corroding? Nobody asks, why did the customer get it wet? You know, or that wasn't a design spec, so we can't solve that one. Or I just heard it you got to do root cause analysis. 5 Whys is one of the tools for that. But you can't rely on, you know, any one of these little tools, and I'm, you know, 5 Whys isn't a little tool. It's a very effective one, but it doesn't solve the underlying problems unless you really dive into that.
Yeah. I don't think you stop necessarily after 5 Whys, you know, you keep going. It could be 7 or 10 Whys until you get to that root cause.
Well, you've seen it though, Chris, and this might be an episode on root cause analysis, is they, you get a failure and it's a part of an injection molded piece is failed, broken off or whatever. And the design engineer has a choice. Do we do the finite element analysis and understand the stresses and the strength of that and do some experiments and design the appropriate flange for that piece? Or we just say, oh, that was a material defect, we're moving quick, let's ignore that for now. And then, you know, half the parts fail 3 months in the field. It's got to get, failure analysis is golden. And you need to understand it in detail. And I agree, you need to dive in deeper and deeper. That's also seen counter to moving fast. It's way too often I've seen in startups where they say, oh, well, that failed. All right, well, just let me make that thicker and we'll move on. Without understanding the forces involved, without understanding how it was used, without understanding the material properties. And sometimes it works. Unfortunately, sometimes it doesn't. So well, how do you balance that, you know?
Yeah, I don't completely agree with how you're presenting the 5 Whys, because it seems like the examples you're giving, you're stopping at like a convenient solution.
Well, if I'm pushed for time, I've got 40 different things to solve, right? Just make it bigger. I'll move on. It's solved. It's expedient, right? It's a real pressure these design teams have.
Yeah, it's true. Eric Ries makes a case for, and I mean, I certainly, and you certainly would make the same case that we got to get to that root cause and then drive, you know, a continuous improvement. Mm-hmm. So we don't have that type of failure, either the specific failure or that type of failure again. Mm-hmm. And I believe that's where the reliability engineer could also come in driving those five whys with the right rigor that you get continuous improvement out of that exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and not just a Band-Aid of making something thicker.
Right, right. Oh, I agree. And, you know, a good way to supplement that is with those stress tests like HALT and just test to failure, get your initial prototypes or mock-ups or whatever, and go make them fail as many ways as you can. And then the five whys and root cause analysis really nails down what you got to solve. Just getting that first prototype in a team that's trying to move fast. Oh, is that that's the challenge.
Yeah.
A lot of times.
And they won't give it to you for destructive testing.
Oh, no, no. You want to break it? No, no. All right. Well, let's let the customers do it. And let's, you know, yeah, there's plenty of challenges in the lean. And I think we only mentioned a couple of them. So it's, you know, I'm thinking of handing off to our listeners here and say, you know, if you're working, if you are in this lean startup or a team that's really trying to go fast and get the minimum viable product out there, you know, have you solved it? Have you sorted out a way to get reliability built into it? Let us know over at reliability.fm. You can find the Speaking of Reliability show and plenty of comment fields and ways to give us feedback. We'd love to hear from you, you know. But Chris, you know, it might be a whole nother episode because some of the challenges in that environment is more related to soft skills, is how do you present this material? How do you tie into what's important and connect reliability is aligned with that and where it really is. It's more how do you communicate to a large degree.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So we should probably come back and talk about that as a separate whole skill set. And then you have the challenge on top of that. That might be another episode after that is when they're so busy, they don't even show up at the meetings, right? Everybody's working at home or they're working so fast, they don't even look up to talk about anything, much less reliability. That's another challenge. How do you work in that environment? Not that I like meetings, mind you. Don't invite me to a meeting, but how do you get somebody's attention? And at least get some consideration of reliability on the table so you can make progress. So a couple of topics. Well, thanks for reaching out to me, Chris, and saying, hey, let's record an episode. This is an interesting problem you brought up. I don't know if we helped you at all.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it was my pleasure talking with you and looking forward to our next talk.
All right, cool. All right, we'll wrap it up here. Thanks so much, Chris. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Brett.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.